The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
And this week on Where Did the Road Go, we have for the first time a returning guest, someone I enjoyed talking to greatly the first time around, and he's done a bunch of new work since then. So I'd like to welcome back James Swagger. And can you hear me, James?
Hi, Soraya. Great to be back on the show.
Okay. So you have been very, very busy.
I'm always busy, Soraya. I never sit down very much. People love my energy. So I'm told anyway. So.
All right, so last time you were out, we were talking about your book, which you've been working on a follow-up to.
Sure. I've been working on the Megalith Acoustics Mystery. It's still my working title, and it's still a little bit of research to go. Yeah, I'm nearly there, but I'm off to Brittany I've been to Brittany before, and it's my last place to go for the research for the book. So the book's on hold. I could get away without going there and finishing it off. I could have done that a long time ago, but I just want to get that last piece, and I want to go and check back on something over there, because I'm pretty thorough in what I do, and I want it to be right, and I'm going back to Gavrila's passage grave, particularly, and a few others in the Channel Islands as well. I'm joining some dots on the way too, so everything in its own course, like. But yes, I'm that's almost finished. That'll be out in the summertime, the Megalith Acoustics Mystery. And and as I say, I've been off to Peru to do ayahuasca as well, which is part of the research too. Not entirely. There was some personal regeneration, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that too.
Yeah, so that was part of the research for the book too. So yeah, I mean, the sequel, the Megalith Acoustics Mystery, I'm looking into acoustics as healing, but also as, you know, hallucinogenic brews as healing and quartz as healing, all pertaining to the Megalithic Empire. So it's quite a complex set of ideas, but all as a core basis around the acoustics of the Megalithic civilization.
And very different from your first book then.
Yeah, and the thing is, I did both lines of research alongside each other from day one. I mean, I had been aware of the acoustics elements a long time ago, since early 2002, 2003, I'd read about it, never gave it much consideration, became more aware of the astronomy and the archaeoastronomy, and when I got to do the research, I went, hang on a minute, I quite like this acoustic stuff too, and I delved into some of the books again, and more research had been done, and more research had been done on the rock art that wasn't astronomy-based, i.e., entoptic phenomena, altered states of consciousness. I'd also read Graham Hancock's Supernatural in 2006, and when that came out, I think it was 2006, and when that came out, that really opened up the door for me in terms of altered states of consciousness was also an element not being really discussed very much, certainly in Ireland, of these megalithic monuments, even though the evidence is there for all to see. You know, it's all part of the rock art. So this rock art is split down the middle. Some of it's astronomy and some of it's entoptic in this phenomena. So I was aware of all this, and I said from day one, look, you know, I'm not going to go around 60 passage graves in Ireland, 75, I think, and 15 aren't really worth seeing, but I think I've done 75 out of 100, I think. I lost count, really. Like, if you showed me a map, I could tell you how to get there and where to get the keys and where how to get access. You know, I could just rhyme it all off for you. Like, but there's something like 100 plus passage graves in Ireland, and I said, I'm not going to go around and see these all again in 2 years when I want to do the acoustics research. So I doubled up on the acoustics research, thinking I would put it on the shelf, thinking, you know, not much of it, going, look, you know, I'll do it alongside. It won't take me much more time in terms of hours per monument, but over the whole scheme of things, it seemed like quite a daunting task to research two books at the same time, but not if you're having to travel to these very remote places. Yeah. And in the end, to be honest with you, I had to go back over myself and double up on time, and it became quite an entity in itself. So it took me a long time to write that first book, which was very, very short, really. I kept a lot out of it, and I kept it as a data research book, and I held back on some of the stuff I found out about the Dogon. It was still coming in. I was finishing it, and in hindsight, I maybe wanted to put some more stuff in about a background to the Dogon, but I wanted to keep that first book really in my own mind as an archaeoastronomy book so that people could go and use it for data. Yeah, that was kind of the scientist in me wanting to at least finish that and do that. And then the scientist in me wanted to do the same approach for the acoustics book, but I kind of went off on a tangent because it became quite more a complex idea, you know, that first of all, I applied a lot of physics, Soraya, to these ancient monuments, and I'm getting access to West Kennet Longbarrow, which is synonymous with acoustic effects too. And a longbarrow is basically a special type of megalithic tomb. It's basically elongated, like an egg-shaped mound. And longbarrows are just one type of megalithic tomb. There's dolmens, there's passage tombs, you know, so there's various types. I really concentrated on the passage graves of Ireland and outside Ireland too. But there is anomalies like to the design, you know, they're not all exactly the same. And so I'm getting an access to these longbarrows. There is a longbarrow in Ireland inside these passage grave complex, like, so they're not like specific to certain areas, like, but they are typical of southern England. They don't seem to have like the passage graves, they seem to have longbarrows down there.
Okay.
And indeed in Ireland, these passage tombs are typically in the northeast and the northwest. And you have different types of tunes in the southeast and the southwest. So they seem to be kind of a regional thing, which is unexplained too. So again, you know, this megalithic acoustics mystery really opened up for me. And basically, you know, I put a lot of the research on the table. I did it early and I just, like, you know, I didn't know what to make of half of it. And I went, okay, at least you took your measurements. And then I had sound equipment going in and taking all this stuff, lugging it around with me. And, you know, I measured the acoustics of the chambers, the resonance, to be within the male vocal range, which I knew to look for anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean in terms of the resonance of the chamber, not the actual male vocal range, but it all hit within the male vocal range. I was expecting it, because it has been done at Newgrange, it's been done at Loch Crewe. I went to do it to the Carroll Keel complex, which hadn't been done acoustically, so that was new research I said I would bring to the table. I redid some of the stuff at Loch Crewe, which is another megalithic complex just east of Dublin. And these were all places I was doing the astronomy. So I took the equipment with me. It made sense to do that. Well, I didn't do it for every place. Some of it wasn't worth measuring acoustically. Some of it was. And I thought I would get some answers to the rock art. And, you know, I guess my reckoning was, you know, that acoustically induced altered states of consciousness is what I was thinking primarily. And again, you know, in Hancock's book, Supernatural, I was aware of this entoptic phenomena, and he talked about the rock art of South Africa. And I spoke to one of the experts in the university down there, you know, and he gave me some pointers what to look for and what to, and books to read and stuff like that, and research where to go with it, which is very helpful, and I'm very thankful to him. And in the end, I got kind of, I didn't want to get too confabulated with what was going on, like, but it started ahead that way, and I went, okay, look, ground yourself, take the measurements, put it on the shelf until you know what you're doing. So I researched more into the altered states of consciousness, and, you know, I then came across an account of altered states of consciousness, the entoptic phenomena, and then possible like links with hallucinogens, like, you know. And then I also came across accounts of the Hyperboreans being linked with megalithic temples and them having a hallucinogenic drink. So then I started getting swayed more to the hallucinogenic route, and not maybe the acoustic. So I wanted to kind of maybe just see one way or the other which way it was. But it looks like it was a combined effect. And I think now, in hindsight, which is why I've held off on the book for so long, is I want to make sure I know what I'm doing in terms of the research, how I'm putting it all together. I'm putting it in a thorough analysis and a wider complex of the megalithic civilization. And I do think that, you know, quartz as a healing element was embedded in their structures, like particularly in Ireland. There's another place on the Isle of Man in between Britain and Ireland, a little island. There's a quartz chamber there. You know, and the light would get bent 45 degrees as these beams of sunlight or starlight would come in, like, you know, and that would have a magnet. It would make it more magnetic. And making it more magnetic would enhance fertility very, very slightly, but it would have that effect. So I think there was a very much a healing element, and the healing element was sound, with quartz and with medicines like altered states of consciousness induced entheogens, whatever they may be. That's a bit of a grey area at the moment. I do think, you know, that the Hyperboreans, they had a flower, the Niplia flower. Again, it could have been like an ayahuasca type brew that they were making. So totally fascinating subject, you know, and I do kind of, I concentrate on basically the acoustics, basically, of the megalithic monuments. And I talk about the global phenomena of megalithic acoustics, not just particular to Western Europe megalithic civilization. There is an anomalous thing there that, you know, all these ancient cultures that have astronomy embedded in them have acoustics embedded in them. Knowledge of acoustics and knowledge of astronomy alongside moving very heavy stones.
It's not just knowledge of acoustics. It's knowledge of acoustics we don't fully understand.
Yes, exactly. I mean, from my research, it looks like that the internal design of these megalithic tombs had prior knowledge of acoustics. It wasn't accidental. You know, they were putting in special niches, especially in Malta. I mean, when I went to Malta and I seen the sophistication of the Hypogeum, which you have to book in advance to get there, I was very lucky. I mean, I was blessed that I even got into the place, because I turned up and a German tourist lady, she ran a tour group. The tour had been cancelled and she had a book of tickets, and she was just sold them all within 5 minutes. And I just happened to be around at another temple around the corner, and I went, I'll just chance it, and I'll tell a little lie, and I'll try and get in the door, because there's only one of me, and they might add it on, you know, if there's a small enough group. And but I was lucky, and I got in, and I seen it, and I just seen all the engineering design, and I seen similarities with the passage graves of Ireland inside the chambers, like, you know, these little apertures and these very sophisticated acoustics, almost like they were putting bass boxes onto each other, like each room was like its own bass box, like. And there's like a very deep chamber in the bottom of the Hypogeum. You know, it's like it got a sheer drop at the bottom of it. I think they were hitting a bass note in there. So again, this acoustics thing really, like, you know, has blown me out of the water, like, totally, you know, because I'm trying to apply my physics to it, and I have to apply complex, well, it's not complex, it's something to the average layperson maybe complex, but you know, it's got a like a sophisticated knowledge of acoustics and, you know, resonance and how sound waves can coalesce and with each other and cancel out or enhance each other and, you know, produce resonance inside these chambers, like. And it looks like it was designed specifically to hit that male vocal range time and time again. You know, you're getting the male vocal range is what's activating these chambers. A typical arm sound inside these chambers will, you know, the difference with the megalithic tombs and Malta and the Hypogeum is that in Malta, they actually have a carved niche, which they call the Oracle Chamber. And when you speak into this niche, it actually activates the chamber. Whereas inside the megalithic tombs, these chambers, and indeed the megalithic tombs could be called temples. I mean, they concentrate on this tomb function. The temples in Malta, they actually just called temples because all the bodies were found in the Hypogeum. So they call them temples. So there seems to be this dissection between these two very similar, accurately laid out monuments. One's a temple, one's a tomb, but they're both temples. They're both temples in their own right, like. So let's just say that first. But the megalithic tombs stroke temples of Ireland don't have any activation chambers. They basically, you're sitting inside the central chamber, and you could activate them just by speaking in the room as such. But the Hypogeum is totally fascinating, totally blew me away, and it was kind of the last piece of the puzzle for me for the megalithic acoustics mystery.
Well, I know they had done some recent research on even Stonehenge, showing that the acoustic properties of Stonehenge were completely not what they expected, and that it reverbed the sound back and forth between the stones, especially when they made simulations to put all the stones back where they were and then ran the simulation tests.
Sure, yeah. There's been two academic studies done by two separate universities, Dr. Rupert Till and another guy, Dr. Keating. And both of them have done very sophisticated studies. And they show that the sound actually at a certain radius from the center will actually get amplified.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to think about it like this, like, yeah, I do go into Stonehenge in the book, and I didn't just concentrate. I have a whole section on just the megalithic tombs, and that was really the whole idea of the book. But, you know, the Neolithic stroke Stone Age, the new Stone Age, you're talking like stone circles having acoustic effects like Stonehenge. It's the most famous one, but also up in the north of Scotland, there's some acoustics up there too. And the megalithic tombs up there as well. So it's not just tombs and sound chambers. There seems to be a variety of sophisticated acoustics knowledge. But if you think about it, I mean, if you actually put two speakers on a wall, the sound waves will come out, and they're both facing the same direction, and they're both a certain distance apart. There'll be a certain distance off that wall. If you walk in a straight line, you will hear periods of sound. You'll have periods of no sound. Mm-hmm. And it's basically called constructive and destructive interference. It's a schoolboy physics experiment that you would do. And basically, that's the same thing that's happening at Stonehenge. The only difference is it's in a circular motion. Like, I mean, it's going in all directions, not just a flat wall. It's actually a certain perimeter outside that main circle. So what were they doing there? Were they beating and chanting drums? People say that the horseshoe type inner sanctum actually focuses the sound, and that, you know, they could have been beating drums at certain frequencies, theta frequencies they call it, 5 to 15 hertz, typically about 7 or 8 hertz long, but them theta frequencies is what I was also researching in the megalithic chambers too. So I quite like that research that was done at Stonehenge, Soraya. Very interesting. And as I say, it's twofold, you know, there's been lots of research done there.
It seems like there's a couple of things that we find over and over in ancient cultures. We find a lot of sound technology. We find the alignments to stars, and we find I forgot what the third one was, but those are two of the primary things. Anywhere in the world we go, we see those two things over and over again. Oh, and the altered states. We see evidence of altered states of consciousness, which suggests that they weren't living in a society that was as materialistic and as literal as the one we were, because they were actually interacting with different states of consciousness. They were using sound not just for healing or altering states, but maybe even for moving some of these blocks. And if Christopher Dunn's right, you know, sound plays a part in the pyramid as a power plant.
Sure. Have you had Chris on the show?
I have not had Chris on yet, no.
Yeah, he's an awesome guest, like, you know, and he's like very knowledgeable, and he's the people I take up and take note of, you know, because Chris is, you know, and I had Chris on my own podcast on Capricorn Radio, and he really, you know, he sold it for me, because I'm from a systems analyst background in the energy industry, typically electrical energy production, either that's power stations, oil rigs, mm-hmm. systems analyst, very complex, large environments that are industrial processes, like. So I get what he was doing, you know, he was putting an engineering eye onto an engineered machine, because that's what the Great Pyramid is like, you know, and again, sophistication, I go into that in the book too, not particularly just solely Chris Dunn's work, but the variety of work that was done on the Great Pyramid and the Egyptian acoustics, and basically the Egyptians were a sound culture as well as an astronomy based, though little is known about it. And I just had Gary Evans on that, He takes private groups in there, you know, and he does sound chanting, and they say the whole place just resonates. You know, it's just one of the most finely tuned resonance chambers on the planet, like, you know. So, the Egyptians, they're not known for it, like, you know. It's just this. It's branded as a pseudoscience, you know. They got away with this archaeoastronomy of ancient Egypt being a pseudoscience, but it's not a pseudoscience anymore. It's pretty much rigid. It's sitting there, undeniable, you know, and they got away with that for a long time. But now it's pretty much accepted that, like, the astronomy of, even though the ancient Egyptians have nothing but astronomy on their drawings, they have the zodiac, they have, like, stars everywhere. They were obsessed with astronomy. But, you know, matching the like Bovell matching the Bell Stars of Orion up to it, you know. And you know, first these theories came out, they were pseudoscience. Now they're just accepted law.
And you see, it everywhere in the world too, not just in Egypt.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the Egyptians are a special breed. The Egyptologists, I should say, and you know that they. They get to just say pseudoscience every time somebody's got an alternative theory. It's pseudoscience. It's the first thing that comes out of their mouth, you know. But, yeah, and I do think that the acoustics is going to be really looked into in the near future, like, a lot more. Hopefully with Sahih Huas gone, all being well, like. But, yes, I mean, it's a worldwide thing. I mean, look at the Mayans. They had some very sophisticated acoustics alongside very sophisticated astronomy, you know, and this is the thing that I want to figure out, you know, Soraya. This is the complexity that starts to bake my noodle, as I say. but, you know, because it's unexplained. It's like when you start seeing these commonalities, you go, well, is there a common thread? Like, you know, that's the first thing any logical scientific person would look for. They go, well, is there? You're going to analyze this. You're going to go, well, hang on, this culture has got weird acoustics similarities. You got you know, the astronomy, you got same construction technique, you know, you got pyramid building, you got elongated skulls popping up all over the planet. You've got, where you have elongated skulls, you have pyramids. Mm-hmm. And where you have mummification, you have pyramids. People don't know about the Tower of Mummies. I don't know if they're very well known about the Tower of Mummies in China. And they have pyramids over there too, yeah. Riddled with pyramids. They're actually planting forests on the pyramids to disguise them because they don't want to know about them.
Yeah, which is bizarre.
Which is bizarre, you know. You think they would welcome it, but the Chinese are, you know, they don't like outside influence. Like, yeah. They're very closed, and they're a bit more open of late. Like, you know, there's other closed nations worse than them now, but maybe Korea. But you know, it's they still are hiding their heritage. Like, you know, I don't understand that planting the forest on the pyramids. But there was a German guy got in access to them, and that's the only existing footage of them. Like, but yes, I mean, so you got the mummification alongside the pyramid building. Again, in Tenerife, you got the step pyramids over there that most people don't know about. And there's also mummification there, too. And typically, where you have one of these three entities, you have either elongated skulls, mummification, or pyramid building. They all show up, either two out of those three, in the same areas, like, mm-hmm. All around the planet, like. Again, like the Mayans building the same construction techniques with pyramids and astronomy and acoustics, you got to turn around and go, hang on a minute, where's this coming from? Like, but then to see people just brush it off because the time frames don't match.
Right.
You know, but...
And they're a little bit different too.
Yeah, but we don't know, was monuments stripped down and built back up again? You know, I mean, they do say that the Olmecs are the precursor to all Central and South American civilizations. Mm-hmm. You know, and they date to 3000 BC. So, you know, did they hand down knowledge? Did they, you know, did they revamp some of their monuments? Like, you know, but the key thing is, like, the Mayans, again, are one of the ones that are, I wrote a chapter on them too, and their acoustics and astronomy. And, you know, I've looked into a lot of their astronomy, you know, and again, they were masters of observational astronomy. And it's the same type of astronomy. It's like people don't understand what observational astronomy is and how sophisticated it can get. I mean, it takes long periods of time. It takes a lot of calculations and it takes a lot of documenting. I mean, all their books were burnt by R6, I think. Yeah. You know, so yeah. That's a major shame because the records that they had kept, like, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I looked at the whole global acoustic phenomena. And, again, I also looked at the global pyramid building phenomena. I also looked at the global astronomy phenomena, like, you know, and it seems to be all these civilizations are all using the same core ideas. Well, so you naturally think then, you know, are we going back to a pre 3000 BC civilization that went in all directions, basically? You know, was there a loss? Dare we say the dirty A word, Atlantis, like?
And it's ridiculous that that's a dirty word in today's culture. I mean, there are certain things that they have just turned into jokes. UFOs, Atlantis, you know, where they, as soon as they're mentioned, people dismiss them because they're afraid they'll be made fun of if they even consider taking it seriously, even if they're really interested in it.
Sure. Before you even say UFOs there, I just did a show today with Kathleen Marden, who is the niece of Betty and Barty Hill. And now she's even opened up my idea. Not that I was closed to the whole thing. I just never heard anybody's personal accounts one-to-one before, you know? The evidence that she's brought to the table, and I reviewed her book for her, like, you know, it's pretty awesome and detailed, and enlightened me to a lot of disinformation out there too.
Yeah, that's the thing. The government seems to have almost used the UFO phenomena as its test run on disinformation back in the 50s, and never really stopped.
Sure, and I actually personally think that there's a disinformation campaign against Atlantis.
Oh, sure.
As much as the UFO thing, but people don't see that. That's the thing. They see the UFO disinformation and they see the UFO phenomenon. Like, it's a hot topic. But, I mean, you keep getting these programs and documentaries funded to go and find Atlantis in 1500 BC in the Mediterranean. And I just don't agree with that. It ignores all the accounts.
My favorite part is where they say, well, we have to take all the evidence into account. We can't dismiss anything. And then they dismiss... that it's beyond the Pillars of Hercules. They dismiss the size by saying, well, it wasn't that big. If we just take a couple zeros off it, it's like, okay, so you've just changed all the evidence after making a point that you weren't going to do that.
Sure, and they dismissed the 9,000 years old by Plato's as well. Like, you know, so the Greeks are a funny one, you know, and they're one of our best sources for the Hyperboreans, you know, and that's where I kind of draw my line in history, Soraya, at the Greeks and the Romans. I don't like the history after that. I'm just like from the Greeks and the Romans beyond, because it's safe. It's not political, or it's not religious. It's not, you know, it's mysterious. Yeah. And it's probably murky and less known about as much as we would like to, you know, and there's a variety of threads of evidence, but they're our best source for the Hyperboreans, and you know, they're mentioned in Homer's Iliad as well, the Hyperboreans, and you know, I just recently got reacquainted with stuff, and I've been aware of the Hyperboreans. I never gave it any consideration, you know, but like there's six accounts of them by six authors in around Greek and Roman times. And one of the best ones that I think is Diodorus Siculus. And they've also been long associated with the Celts. Now, whether they were a tribe in the Celts or where they were the Celts, I don't think they were the Celts. But they've often been linked with the Ethiopians as well and being a black race. Mm. And this is the thing, because my research had dabbled with the Dogon, and that their art and symbology of the Dogon is the same as the art and symbology of, like I said, in the Newgrange Sirius mystery. Mm-hmm. But then I found myself looking at the Hyperboreans because of their association with Callanish Stone Temple. And Callanish Stone Temple is on the Outer Hebridean island of Scotland, very, very northerly, like. And some of the best accounts of the Hyperboreans actually put them even, some say in the Arctic Circle, that they were very northerly. Some say Scandinavian. There's various accounts. They probably, one account says that they had nine cities and that they were actually like an empire that spanned from the Arctic Circle down through Scandinavia and into Northern Europe. Wow. Yeah, some people talk about one of their southerly parts of the empire was that in near Thrace, which was the Thracian Empire of Bulgaria. Little known about, some artifacts have been dug up quite recently there, this century, like gold and stuff like that. Around that, Thracian would have been the southerlymost point of them. They may have been an Ethiopian cult that actually migrated north. But yes, they have been associated as being a black race. And obviously the Dogon, with their symbology and knowledge of being a black race, so that's what made me peek up. They've also got this hallucinogenic brew, the Niplia flower that I said. Mm-hmm. But the key thing is that Diodorus Siculus wrote about, he was from Sicily, so he wrote about this temple being on an island no bigger than Sicily. So he compared it to Sicily because he was from Sicily. Which is the same size as the Outer Hebrides, the islands that this Callanish temple stands on. So that's one point of reference. Then it was also said that the Pleiades set due west at the, or is it due east or due, the sun, sorry, the Pleiades, the rising of the Pleiades and the sun is seen to set at the equinox. Now this happened exactly at the time that Diodorus Siculus was around in his era. It didn't happen at the time the Calenus was built. So this is the key thing. It actually puts it into the time of writing as well. You know, because the setting and rising of Pleiades and the equinox, only at that latitude. There's nowhere else on the planet that that happened at that time. Hmm. That's the key thing. So the archaeoastronomy tells us this is the temple. So yeah, again, I mean, and there's also a link with the 19-year cycle of the moon at this special Hyperborean temple.
Wow.
So you have, now, and Callanish is known worldwide for its famous moon alignment. The moon actually skims the mountain on the horizon, doesn't set below the mountain, and when it does set below the mountain, it skims the horizon of the mountain only at this latitude, only at this direction. And what happens is every 19 years it does this, and then when it sets just behind the mountain, this is where the main central alignment of Callanish Stone Temple is focused. You know, so a very sophisticated astronomical alignment at this temple. It's also in the shape of the swan.
For Cygnus,
like, so there's a lot of astronomy at play there as well. But the thing is, we have like a reference to Hyperboreans, the temple in the north, and I think there was many temples. I think they actually were a cult or a sect within the Celts, or is maybe the Celts inherited the monuments. Maybe they inherited them from the Hyperboreans, or maybe the Hyperboreans were one sect that worked with the Celts. I'm not quite sure, but they're synonymous together anyway. There's a variety of counts, and they all differ slightly. And this is the thing, it gets a bit murky, but the Hyperboreans are totally fascinating. The class is a fictional race of people, even though there's a lot of historical accounts of them, and even though there's a lot of historical referenced evidence of them. Which is bizarre that they're classed as mythological, and I would have been guilty of reading that when I was younger. So that's where my route went into, you know, because I became aware of the links with Hyperboreans and the megalithic temple, and therefore by default, if you can link the Hyperboreans to the megalithic temple of Callanish, then you're linking it to all megalithic temples or monuments in the British Isles, and therefore everywhere else. Like, so in doing that, then, and them having a hallucinogenic brew, you know, you're therefore, you know, you're putting pieces and various threads of evidence together. The art at Newgrange and notes tells us there was all the states of consciousness going on, and the megalithic Callanish Stone Temple tells us that the Hyperboreans there with their hallucinogenic brew. So, you know, you're coming at this thing from two different sides. So that's where things kind of gelled for me, Soraya. But it's totally fascinating, and I'm totally hooked on the Hyperboreans, and, you know, it's such a vast, there's so many varied accounts of them. I mean, another account talks about them, the sun only set once a year, which is why people think they were living in the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
Which is then would explain, you know, I never understood why they were building temples in the Orkneys and the Outer Hebrides. I mean, I live at the very top of Ireland, and it's pretty rough here. Like, I've been living on the Outer Hebrides before, and I've worked on the Orkneys as well for about 2 or 3 months, and that was it. I just wanted to, everybody that worked there just wanted to leave after 2 months. 2 months was like, I don't know how the locals survived there. I mean, the locals go around in Helly Hansen Arctic gear. You know, and people in Britain don't understand how remote Scotland is. Scotland's is like almost half the length of Britain, like, you know, it's from top to bottom, like, you know, it sticks up quite a lot, like, you know, but the Orkneys and the Outer Hebrides, they're pretty rough, like, you know, I mean, they get really rough winters. I mean, the wind speeds up there and the rain, like, you know, they get battered, like, you know, you want to be pretty hardy to live there, like. So I never understood why, you know, they would build the megalithic temples there. You know, but if they were living from the Arctic down, like, you know, that would have been like warm to them. So,
right.
So maybe, you know, and that's something that kind of clarified for me, you know, in researching the Hyperboreans, like. But I really do, you know, the ayahuasca trip, excuse me, the ayahuasca trip for me was enlightening, because I got something out of it that I wasn't expecting. I was hoping I would, but, well, you know, I seen entoptic phenomena on the trip, and it was exactly the same as a rock art at one of the pastor's graves.
Nice.
And it was like, yeah, and it's actually, when I came home, I looked up the entoptic phenomena charts, and I went, you know, to look through them, and I went, oh, right, and I just remembered the visions that I had, and I didn't study the entoptic phenomena charts before I went, fingers crossed I would see them, mm-hmm. you know, I wasn't mm-hmm. looking for them when I was on the trip, and I went, look, hopefully you'll get an idea of what entoptic phenomena is. So I did it in reverse, so as not to, you know, to do it with an open mind and not right. to encourage stuff, you know, to do it like, you know, that it would come to me and not have to look for stuff like, you know. So I was there for research, Soraya. I was also there for a personal regenerative spiritual experience with the shamans, like, you know, that was kind of, it was a twofold thing. I was aware of this powerful spiritual entity, Mother Ayahuasca, and I'd researched and read about it an awful lot. So I did want to go for personal reasons too. So it was quite a joy for me to do that and have for research for my book, because I wanted to take a really powerful hallucinogen. And I do think there's like DMT drinks that are lost to mankind, like, you know.
Sure.
And Graham Hancock spoke on the TEDx talk there about the Egyptian tree, the Egyptian flower of life tree, the Acacia nicolata, nilotica, I think it is, that it's got high quantities of DMT in it. Like, so, you know, I do think that we've got these lost cultures, these mystery races, like, of lost cultures with DMT brews, like, you know, and it's not just an ayahuasca. I mean, in the because there's DMT in various plants. So yes, I mean, having hallucinogenic brews, like, you know, I think there was various plants all around the planet activated at one time, and I think ayahuasca is the only one that survives, and luckily so that we have a plant teacher like that.
All right, well, we got to take a quick 45-second break. When we come back, we'll talk sure. some more about that and your trip to Peru.
Sure.
We'll be right back with James Swagger.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, links section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And as that just said, there's tons of stuff on the website. Go check it out. There are book reviews. There, you can subscribe to us any number of ways. And if you're listening live, you can come into the chat room and send me questions, and I'll pass them along to our guests. And that's at www.wheredidtheroadgo.com. And tonight we are talking to James Swagger, our first second-time guest. Hey, James.
Hey, Soraya. Good to be back.
And so now you made this trip to Peru. When was this?
A few weeks ago, probably now. You've got me on the dates. I don't do dates very well.
Yeah, me neither.
Probably about a month ago, but I went for like 3 weeks, yeah, two and a half weeks.
The pictures were fantastic that you put up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually for the first time went somewhere to do research, but I also switched off as well, and that's not like me, because normally I've been going around the world looking at, it's always megalithic sites, it's always an ancient site or a sacred site, it's always something I'm going to write about, you know, and mm-hmm. I mean, I'm going to Malta, and like, and I spend minutes at places, maybe an hour at most, like, you know, and I go to very remote places, mm-hmm. spend a short period of time, get what I want out of it, and go, you know, and people think it's glorious traipsing around the world, like, and it could be. I mean, I could spend other time doing things, like, but the point is that when I went to Peru, I actually did take time out to do other stuff as well, like, so that was quite different for me, but, because I promised myself, like, I mean, I went to, when I went to Malta, I went to the North Island of Gozo, and I went to Gigantea Temple, which is dated to around 2600 BC, and the oldest temple structure in the world, probably second now to Göbekli Tepe, now that that's a class as a religious structure, stroke temple. But, you know, so it's quite important. Like, but I just literally went there for half an hour. Like, I mean, I had to travel like to the north of the island 2 hours, then get a ferry, and then travel another hour and a half by bus up to the place, like. Spent 20 minutes there and had to go back, like, so, I mean,
almost doesn't seem worth it.
Yeah, well, it was worth it for me, because I want to see megalithic monuments. That's what I'm about, like, you know, I'm trying to put pieces together, like, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I went to see, the point is, like, you know, I go to all these places, and after Malta, I went, no, the next time I go somewhere, I'm going to do a tourist thing. I'm going to do something just for me as well. So I split the trip into Peru in two, and I went, do all the megalithic sites first, and I did, you know, and I've been totally bamboozled by Sacsayhuaman. Probably the one thing that hits me or reminds me over there for the megaliths over there. I mean, they're monstrous stones, all shaped with weird angles, all interlocking, but it's 3D as well. We look at the wall as a 2D image, but you have to forget, like, it's 3D, like, you know, it goes into the wall. The stones are 3D as well, like, you know, incredibly difficult thing to do. I'd think if you give somebody that to do today, they would actually have to build a miniature model of that and finish it. Removable pieces to get that to work. I can't see you doing that any other way. Like, you know, it's totally insane, that place. Like, you know, and I have a picture there of me with my hand. I'm 6'3", and I have my hand upwards on the rock, and I'm only reaching halfway.
Wow.
You know, and it's like 8-9 sides on it, and it's about 120 tons, I think it is. It weighs, like, and it's just one piece in a wall. Like, you know, it's the biggest complex jigsaw I've ever seen.
And where was that?
That was Sacsayhuaman, just above Cusco. I mostly spent most of my time around Cusco. I mean, I went to see all of the places. I mean, I went to see Moray as well, which has got some strange acoustics going on there as well. It's like these two bowls. There's actually three of them, but two are right beside each other. They're these, like, terraced bowls carved down into the ground. And every time I went to these places, there was panpipes playing. There was locals just playing panpipes. Hmm. And the sounds were just going around the valley, like. Pizac as well got some strange acoustics going on there. And, I mean, when you look at Pizac from the air, it's in the shape. You can only see it from the air. It's the temple complex built on top of it. It's in the shape of the condor, the head of the condor. Hmm. And the mountain that it's built on is in the shape of the wings of the condor. So it looks like a condor from the air. Totally out there and bizarre. It's nuts, like. I mean, Peru is on a scale unprecedented, like, you know. I traipsed around for the first 7 days doing all the megalithic sites, and I was looking for, I went there with the acoustics in mind too, and I'm doing a chapter on the Peruvian acoustics too. And you know, I do believe in the pre-Inca civilization. They say when the Spanish came there, that they just thought that the Incas built all these places, and the Incas said, no, we inherited them, like, and right. They went, okay, and then the Spanish still recorded them as building it, which I never really understood, but
they probably figured who else would have built them other than the people that are already here.
Yeah, exactly.
And, so, and you know, they dealt with the Aztecs as stupid savages, so.
Yeah, and even at that, like, you know, they worshipped the snake and the serpents as well, and that was another reason I wanted to take the ayahuasca. So having got all the megalithic monuments out of the way first, and you know, bar Machu Picchu, I did that at the very end, but I had gone to all these megalithic monuments, got what I wanted out, and got my research done, and I had taken the ayahuasca too, and I was very attracted to this idea of serpents inside the brew, like, if you want to call it that. And I mean, I met the mother god, the earth god, ayahuasca, if you want to call it Gaia, or I actually was lucky enough to meet her. She came out and gave me love and nurturing. She almost looked like Medusa, if you want to call her that. And she had strange hair that was like, the tail ends of the hair had serpents' heads on it. Like, it was like, almost like dreads, if you know what I mean. But the ends of the dreads were serpents' heads. Bizarre, like, you know, she was purplish, greenish skin, and, you know, but not scary in any way. None of this was any... when you describe these images, people would automatically get scared and go, would that not freak you out? Like, and it wasn't like that. I wasn't freaked out in any way, but I was there to explore the serpents of it. And, you know, and I do believe that, you know, St. Patrick chasing the serpents out of Ireland is a figurative ideology, like, to what the Celts, you know, people actually think it's still in this country today where I'm sitting. They think about, they actually chase physically serpents out of Ireland. But, you know, the Celts, there's often pictures of the Celts hanging and holding serpents, you know, and, you know, they were obsessed with the serpentine ideology as well, like, you know, and that's another thing that I was thinking about, like, you know, and so I wanted to go and experience that for myself. And personally, like, I mean, I was in... I was flabbergasted by the amount of serpents that appeared to me. Like, I mean, they were very colorful. They were fluorescent and iridescent and luminous, you know, and beautiful oranges and yellows and pinks and purples and, you know, not like in any snake that I've ever seen, unless it's a really colorful, rare snake or something, you know, but all these mad, strange, beautiful colors, like, you know, but not scary in any way. You know, I'm not one for snakes in the real world. I'm not one for insects or spiders or moths. Moths is my biggest fear. I have a fear of moths. Like,
really?
You know, yeah, it's strange. I don't know what anybody else. Even butterflies I'm scared of as well. Like.
Well, you're not. I know someone else who's afraid of butterflies, so you're not alone.
They're just a pretty moth, if you ask me.
Moth. Okay, I thought you said moss.
No, moths.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm not pronouncing my H there. So yeah, moths. So yeah, I mean, I've got these weird things that I don't like, you know, but the whole idea is that, like, you know, the serpents that I met, like, it wasn't scary in any way. I welcomed them, like, you know, and I should just say my experience, like, you know, I didn't know what I was kind of going to experience. You can only read about so much in a book, like, you know.
Yeah.
But, I had this level for a while, and I was able to hold the drink down for about 3.5 hours, I think it was, the first one, like. And then after that, he gave me a second dose. So I had the stuff in the body, like, for a long period of time, where the other two people struggled a little bit. They could only hold it down for 20 minutes, like.
Did they throw it up afterwards?
Yeah. So, I mean, before I threw up, it was like, before I purged, as they call it, and, like, I was, like, maybe 3.5 hours, so it really took effect on me, like, you know. And that's where I wanted to go anyway. I wanted the biggest hit I could get, like, you know. I wanted to get serious about it. I did prepare my body as well, and I am vegetarian anyway, but I took vegan meals and all that week beforehand, and really got into drinking pure water and stuff, and really prepared the body for it, like, you know, because it's gonna get a hammering. Your body takes a hammering, like.
Oh, I'm sure.
But I mean, the first hit, I got waves of euphoria, and I felt my consciousness leaving the body and very much detaching, thinking more. And I was actually vocally saying out loud, take me away. Wherever I was going, I was just floating around the room. I was loving it. I was just in this euphoria wave, and it was wave after wave. And the shaman kept asking me, am I okay, you know, and he's checking in with, you know, and he's playing music and chanting, and he'd stop periodically and then get up again. And he's, every time he asked me, I just said, I'm good. Like, you know, I'm just, take me away. Like, you know, I was talking out to Mother Ayahuasca. Like, I was just, have me, just do what you got to do with me. Like, you know, so I pretty much jumped into it. The other two beside me, like the other guy on the right, like, he really struggled. I don't think he liked the physical discomfort on the body. And I did have some physical discomfort, and I did feel like getting sick a couple of times, but I just thought about the euphoria, and I was able to somehow trick myself going, well, okay, I'm back in the euphoria buzz, and I forgot about getting sick now. So maybe that's why I held it down for so long.
Yeah.
Then when I had taken the second, I had got some hallucinations, but they were intermittent and not very intense. By the time I took the second hit and I had the second glass, I mean, I regretted it at one point, going, why did you take the second one? You're stupid. Like, there's only one way out of this now, and you've got to ride this one out, you clown. But I'm glad I did now, and in hindsight, because I got, like, to where I needed to go personally, totally regenerative, totally spiritually enhanced. Enhanced my memory, my love of the world, and I'm really a happy-go-lucky type of guy. I'm not in any, you know, I wasn't in any dark place going into there anyway.
I saw you going out and hugging some trees afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, I'm out hugging trees every day now. It's something I would never have done before, that, like. But, yeah, I love it, like, you know. I'm out there, I'm walking in the forest every day now. I'm taking time out for nature, Soraya, you know. Mm-hmm. I live in one of the nicest parts of the north of Ireland here. I mean, I'm overlooking a lake here. And I look out to the mountains at the back of the lake, and I'm like, got like an 18-acre forest beside me, and I don't even go and walk around it, like, you know. And so I've really taken time out for nature. I don't go more than 2 days without taking time out for nature. I've got waterfalls. I've got, like, I can go up to my nearest mountain and see Scotland across the ocean, like, you know. It's nice. That close to us. So, like, I'm in a very nice territory here, but I mean, I'm taking time out for nature, like, you know. And ayahuasca told me to do that. Ayahuasca gave me a hard time about that, going, like, you know, you don't need to be so analytical and so, you know, scientifically minded. Take your time out. you have it in you, like, and I know I have it in me, like, I do appreciate nature. I've lived in the Brecon Beacons National Park in Wales, like, as well at one point, you know, and I've lived down in Cornwall as well, in southern England, you know, and I've lived in really nice places. I've also lived in, as I said, in Scotland, like, I've lived all around the UK and the British Isles. I've lived in some very nice places, like, and, you know, I for all the time I was there, I spent so little time enjoying the environment. So I'm out every other day at least, you know, enjoying the environment. And I've got some lovely waterfalls up there, you know, and I'd actually just go and appreciate it, like, you know, and I'm making the time to do that, like, you know, and I feel better for it. I really feel better for it.
Like. Sure.
But I mean, the serpents thing as well, I didn't know what to expect with the serpents, but I can understand this serpent cults that exist, like, you know, the Aztecs, they worship this, they worship the snake. They actually believe that when that snake was dropped by an eagle, I think it was, I don't know how the story goes, but they would build their city there. And that's where they built the city of Tenochtitlan on the Reed Island. I mean, the snake was dropped. They actually witnessed a bird dropping a snake, the snake that they worshipped, into a swamp. And that's why they actually built it. They actually built Reed Islands so that they could build their city into the swamp, like, you know, because that's where the snake was dropped. That's how dedicated they were to this location, like, you know. But so these snake cults, or if you want to call them that, I really do think they were freaking DMT brews, like, you know. There's also the San Pedro cactus that I didn't get a chance to try. I would have liked to. I'm not in any way going to go out of my way to go and do this several more times. Like, I don't feel the need to do that. If I'm back in Peru in some time in the near future, I might try the San Pedro cactus, and I might try ayahuasca again. Mm-hmm. I'm not sitting there dedicated to dying to try it again, really. And it's not because of any physical discomfort. I just don't feel the need. I got what I needed out of it, you know. And I if I'm back there, maybe, yeah. I know, when in Rome, go see the Pope, as they say. I was just on the serpents thing. I mean, the serpents were coming up to me and showing me their face, and it was always just a face on the neck of the, like a cobra would rise and look at you. That's what the serpents were arising to me, and I was so strong at one point. I mean, I couldn't even orate to the shaman what was happening, and he's like, visions, like, strong. I was trying to say that, and I just too strong. I couldn't even put a sentence together.
That was, you know, the second dose, right?
Yeah, and he thought I was trying to say, I am strong. You know, the other guy was from Korea, and there was a lot of broken English, and everybody was kind of speaking English. He could speak Spanish, the Korean guy, so there was some sort of translation going on. It was very erratic, like, the conversation, like, but it was funny, though, as well. And but, like, I was trying to explain this, and then I started, because then I was reduced my sentences to one word, I had to start thinking of the word I could say that would say the most, and I couldn't even speak at one point, like, you know. I was lying there with just drool pouring out of my mouth and all the visions coming at me, like, you know. And I said serpents, and then the shaman was like, ah, good, you know. And he was like, going, personalize your trip, you know, get there, get, ask these guys what they are, and all. I also seen anthropomorphic figures, not particularly like Egyptian ones. Mm-hmm. I can't even say I identified them. I didn't hold the visions that long. The serpents were the ones visions that I seen the most. And the serpent's face was peeling back, and it only peeled back when I realized something. This is the thing. And this was the tuition I was getting, that, like, the serpents were there to teach me something. And the serpent was there going, what do you want to know? And I would have a thought, and I would go, right, there's the question, and there's the answer. And, I mean, the answer was almost provided to me. And it was, like, very personal things about my family, stuff I hadn't realized, stuff I'd overlooked, hundreds of key little ideas. Some of it not too important, some of it very significant. You know, and there was no one thing, it wasn't. And this was, like, as fast as I could take this in for about an hour. You know, like, it was just coming at me like a roller coaster. So these serpents were popping up. As soon as the question was understood, the answer was delivered. As soon as the answer was understood, the next serpent would peel back from that serpent's face, and another one would pop up. And it would be a totally different colored serpent. Unbelievable, like, you know, what a journey, like, you know. I wasn't expecting that intensity, I suppose, Soraya.
How did it change your spiritual outlook from before to after?
Spiritually, I was in a very good place, you know. Spiritually, I've been in a very good place since I gave up my engineering game and work, and dedicated myself to my writing, because I'm following a dream, you know. And I'm happy where I'm at in my life. So just saying that, before I went there, you know, I'm very happy in myself. You know, and I hadn't been in my youth, like, I should say that. I mean, I had a lot of troubled youth, like, you know, variety of situations, like, you know, and struggles, like, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm very fortunate as well that I've got through it, like, you know. But so, yeah, I mean, I'm at a good place now. I'm in my mid-30s, like, so well, I'm in a good place going there, you know. Like, but, yes, I mean, family issues and personal relationships, my memory as well, like, you know, my memory and consciousness is definitely being more. I mean, I'm pretty aware and I'm very aware of events in the world, and I'm very aware of people. I don't do bad deeds to people. I try to lead a good life. I try to just do an honest, good day's work. You know, I just try to be empathetic to people, you know. You know, I lead an okay life. I don't like to, I believe in karma as well, you know. So I was okay going in, if you know what I mean. I know there's people go in with troubles and they come back out spiritually redeemed. But for me, I was redeemed without expecting to be redeemed, if you know what I mean, Soraya. Mm-hmm. You know, and that is that love and compassion. It's been enhanced. If I didn't need it, like I did, I wouldn't have thought I maybe needed it, but it's not a bad thing, Soraya, you know. Even the key little things that I thought have been good to people, and maybe I've been like short with people, or, you know, certainly a lot of family issues has come up for me, you know. It was very personal for me, like, so, right. You know, I got a lot of stuff resolved there, and stuff with my dad too, you know. My dad was very controlling growing up, like, you know, and I understood more about I analyzed his methods and why he is the way he is, and I got stuff, you know, the penny dropped, as they say. Stuff that I never gave time to think to, and, you know, and so I've resolved a lot of issues, and I understand, like, you know, people are people at the end of the day, and everybody's different, like, you know. And just saying that afterwards, like, this wasn't just a momentary thing on the ayahuasca, like, it's been lasting since that. I mean, I after the ayahuasca session, like, I mean, I then, the day after, I went on a 5-day hiking trip to the Salkantay Glacier. I hiked up a glacier that was at the highest peak was 4,600 meters, close to 15,000 feet, which I hiked up there on foot, like, and then walked 80 kilometers from that glacier to Machu Picchu, like. So I was hiking for 5 days, like, wow, on foot. And I went through quite a physical ordeal doing that. But, I mean, what got me through that was the uplifting adventure that I had. I connected with people. I mean, there was a group of 16 people on that trip, from the Spanish guys, a German couple, an Australian couple, and a group of English girls as well, like, you know. And there was all these people that I met, like, you know, the old stories to tell. They were all asking me about my experience, my authorship, like, you know, and books that I do, like, you know. And I was asking about their lives, and I was genuinely interested, and I was like, you know, it's not all about me in this world, you know. It's about connecting with people, and I do lead a quite secluded life sometimes. I switch off in the world, and I hibernate as such, like, you know. And mm-hmm. It was nice for me to do that, like. And even the conversations that I was having with the people, Soraya, was like the information that is in my head. And I'm quite a factual person, like, I mean, I read a book every other day, like, you know. And even documentaries I had been watching from nature channels and Discovery Science from years ago, the information I was just coming out of me, like, it was like the library had just exploded in my head, and just the books were coming out, all the information, like, you know. And so my memory just jumped up, like, you know. There was a jump in brain power there. You know, and so what I was referring it through conversations to anecdotal stuff, like, you know, the information was just on my fingertips, if you want to mean, you know.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
It is, you know, and it's awesome. I wasn't expecting that after the event, you know.
Did you do it inside or outside?
It was in a ceremonial hut, if you want to call it. That was like a circular room, like a mud hut. Quite big though, like, I mean, it had a conical roof on it, like with logs and straw, and they had skylights looking out to the stars as well. Nice. And the room would sleep maybe 20 people, although you don't sleep in there. It would, like, there was like 20 beds with like lovely blankets. I mean, I had 15 blankets at me at one point, because it's like your body temperature drops. And this is what the shaman does, though. The shaman will know where you're going, because when your palms will get sweaty or clammy, and, you know, your body temperature drops and you feel cold, and he knows then. He keeps going, you okay? And he goes, are you cold? And I just thought he was genuinely asking if he was a cult, but I didn't get that. You know, I understood what he was doing at one point then. I was like, you know, because when your body temper drops, you're going back on the trip again. You know, you're mm-hmm. you're going back to these waves of euphoria and visions and stuff. So he would come over and he would move you, put you on your side so that you would make sure that your body's digesting the ayahuasca and it's doing its thing. It's going through your system. And he would also put blankets on you. But I remember having something like 15 blankets at one point and a little Peruvian hat on me and being all cozy. And like, nice. It is such a beautiful, happy place, like, you know. But right. I must say, like, you know, even the physical discomfort of actually the purge of getting sick wasn't even that bad. I didn't even know what I was doing. I didn't even know what, like, I mean, I remember it was very intense on my stomach muscles. Like, I feel my stomach muscles revolving, like, and trying to get up. But, I mean, I've been sick before and felt the feeling of being sick. But mm-hmm. it was like, when I was getting sick, I was that out of it on the hallucinogen. I was like, there were serpents all around me in my head. Like, I mean, I was just trying to get the act over. It was like I was trying to get the act over and done with, but not being even aware of the intensity of the act, like, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. The physical discomfort of it, like. It was just like, it was bizarre. Like, it was like somebody else was getting sick for me, like.
Right, disconnected.
Disconnected in a way, yeah. But, like, I mean, it wasn't like, I mean, and even the taste of the ayahuasca wasn't that bad for me. It's not a taste you pleasantly want to drink, but I do drink very bitter coffee, like, you know, and bitter lemon taste. I take a lot of chili and garlic in my diet, like, you know, so I like pretty, I don't have a sweet tooth. I don't take milk. I don't take sugar. I don't take cream cakes or anything like that. You know, I just eat solid, wholesome food all the time with chili, garlic, and very strong, pungent, acidic taste, like. So the ayahuasca, even the taste of it, like, was it's pretty disgusting to most. Like, it doesn't smell good, it doesn't taste good, it's pretty foul, like, you know, it's like not something you willingly want to go and drink, like. But I didn't mind it as much. It didn't repulse me. There wasn't a repugnant abhorrent taste, like, you know. It wasn't that bad, but it was to the others, like, they weren't, I don't mind those bitter tastes, like, you know.
Yeah. All right, well, we're just about out of time.
Sure.
You have, your main website is what?
JamesSwagger.com. That's, it's two G's for Swagger. JamesSwagger.com. And that whole saw all my work there. I've a lot of sites being revamped at the moment, but they're all down at that site. My Megalith Acoustics book will be out in the summertime, all being well. I'm hoping for the end of June at this point.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so the new website for that will be New Grange Acoustics. My other site for the first book is newgrangecosmology.com.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, they're all hosted on jamesswagger.com. You can find my Capricorn Radio podcast there as well, which is kind of taking a life of its own at the moment, which is good.
You have some excellent shows up there.
Yeah, you know, and it's become quite rewarding for me too, Soraya. You know, it's nice to get information out there, and it's nice to I try to get guests on that I like and I'm interested. I have many interests, Soraya. You know, I've got many interests. Some of the megalithic stuff is probably on ancient civilizations, maybe transoceanic contact, Egyptians. It's the only stuff that I like to write about. It's a certain genre, but I like to research a lot. You know, so I like to research outside the stuff that I'm going to write, like. You know, it's...
And you seem to be expanding your subject base on Capricorn Radio as well.
Sure, yeah, that's the idea. You know, and it's, a lot of people are coming to me too now, Soraya. You know, so I started off pretty much similar time as you. I like what you do, and I like some of the shows that you do too. I've tuned into a few, so... I'm trying to expand the knowledge base, but people are coming to me too, Soraya. It's growing itself now, and I get a lot of feedback on the show. And I ask if anybody wants to tune in, capricornradio.com, send me emails of guest requests and what you think of the shows. I love to see feedback. It actually encourages me to do more. It really does, like, and that's what I like to get out of life, you know, encouragement and feedback. And because you know you're on the right track then, Soraya, you know.
Certainly, absolutely. So after your book comes out, we'll have you back on and we'll talk about the book more.
Sure. And, yeah, the Megalith Acoustics Mystery. I'm keen to get it finished now. I'm in writing mode at the moment, Soraya, you know, and I actually had a little bit of writer's block. I do tend to go through months of writer's block and then getting to it, like, but I was in a little writer's block mode in Peru, and I found some acoustics there I never even got to mention. Like, I did find, we'll finish up on this, that, you know, I was there to go and see Murray and a couple of acoustics things that I'd singled out, like, but and the last day I was there, a Chechua native guy told me at the Curry Cancha about these three curious holes. And I had been to look at these three curious holes on the outside of the Coricancha on two occasions. And I was there the last day, and I went up to the Coricancha. And a native, I must have just been meant to meet him, but he told me that it was like this different, like these cores run through into the inside of the building, and that they are a different length. So you can picture three cylindrical holes running a different length. They're almost like a pan pipe. And he said that when the winds blow, they would blow through and make a whistling sound into the Coricancha. And that would activate the sound chambers, because the inside rooms have these niches carved almost like the oracle hole in Malta, and almost like the recesses in the megalithic chambers, like, but smaller niches, like. And these niches would have an acoustic effect. I mean, when I was in Machu Picchu, I stuck my head in one of these niches, and the other guy down at the other end could hear what I was saying clearly. Like, the sound was in your head. Like, I mean, the sophisticated acoustics going on.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, again, jamesswagger.com is your website.
Sure, jamesswagger.com.
All right. Last Exit for Loss is up next. We're going to take you out with Psyche Corporation as usual. We'll be back next week with Andrew Collins, actually. We'll be talking about his book on UFOs as well as Göbekli Tepe. See you next week.
Come in. Do you read me? Do you understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection? Singing, soaking into our transmission. 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. And counting. Can you hear?